everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American empire, 1000 BC, when we come back. You know, here's an interesting statement. It says, "Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said that we ought to obey God rather than men." You find that in Acts 5, verse 29. You know, that's a revolutionary concept, and it's impossible to put into practice unless you know the law. Now, can you imagine yourself actually telling a policeman or a judge that the law of God supersedes the law of the state? Well, there are actually three principles of law, three sources of law that support Peter's position in Acts 5, verse 29. Here in the United States, the First Amendment to our Constitution is number one. Second, Public Law 97-280, also known as Statute 96-1211, is the second enacted by our Congress. The third principle of law, or source of law, is our U.S. Supreme Court in a decision called Seeger versus United States, and that's the third source. Now, do you know the scriptural law to cite in support of your position on, say, the census or public school, Social Security, vaccinations, or the many other laws of the scripture that conflict with the laws of the state? And do you know how to look them up, research them out, code plead the law, and use the scripture to defend yourself against state and federal incursion into your constitutionally protected rights? Because if you don't know the law of the scripture and you don't know the law of the state, then you're in no position to challenge either one, are you? Now, if you're tired of being a biblical illiterate with the police and public officials kicking sand in your face, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. You can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. That's the place to start. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about the Golden Empire, the Golden Age of Israel, which was under the reign of King Solomon, after David had conquered most of the Middle East, that is, at least from the Nile River to the Euphrates River, and probably the peninsula of Saudi Arabia, as we know it today, as far north as Turkey and the Black Sea. That's a pretty good-sized piece of real estate. They also, that is King David and King Solomon, his son, established a worldwide trading empire in which we find Hebrew inscriptions by the hundreds all over North and South America, including pyramids that are exact replicas in Mexico and South America of the pyramids that we find in Mesopotamia and that we find in Egypt. And that's because Egyptian hieroglyphics that we find on pyramids and monuments in the New World came from Egyptians who were trading here in the New World right alongside the Hebrews and the Phoenicians. Now, the early American colonists saw these stone structures built by an earlier civilization as free building materials, and they dismantled them. And while the colonists did not realize how ancient these structures were, it has been determined that the site was used from the second millennium BC through about 800 to 600 BC, and such dates are entirely consistent with the biblical accounts of the Israelites and their Phoenician allies. Now, while Kings David and Solomon were worshippers of the Bible's God, that is the God of Abraham, most of the Israelites and the Phoenicians and their kings and nobility served Baal. They were sun-worshipping Baal worshippers. And we would expect to see Baal worship dominant in the New World and in this New World site as well. And the dates of 800 to 600 BC marked widespread Baal worship in Israel and the Phoenician city-states, and it is therefore very logical that the same pagan religion would be dominant in their ancient American colonies, and indeed it was. Now, this priceless archaeological site was mostly dismantled by American colonists whose need for building materials outweighed their desire to preserve the remnants of an ancient civilization. And Dr. Fell notes that what happened to the structures at this ancient site, he said, quote, large numbers of them were dismantled and their stones used for making dry stone walls. During the period from 1823 to 1848, about 40% of the stone structures in the New World were destroyed or damaged severely by building contractors who visited the area to obtain stone for dams and bridges. Unquote. Now, Dr. Fell determined that these ancient sites were composed of stone slab chambers and associated henge stones, which were cited for determining the times of spring and winter solstices. And he further observed that the original use of the facility as an ancient temple site was abundantly attested by the number of temple dedications that we have since found in these stone walls. That ancient Old World Semitic civilizations built a large temple observatory complex in ancient America and used it for centuries indicates that they were systematically exploiting and colonizing ancient America. A four-cornered copper ingot was a well-known commercial item traded in the Old World. And Dr. Fell notes that ingots found in Cyprus and Crete match similar copper ingots found in ancient burial mounds of the Adena and Hopewell cultures in Ohio, West Virginia, Indiana, and Kentucky. And Dr. Fell aptly concludes that the American examples indicate an international trading system intending or extending to the Atlantic states. Now, given the locations where these copper ingots were found, the Phoenicians of Iberia, that is, ancient Spain, were present in the American Great Lakes states as well, and they had a major role in the Adena and Hopewell cultures of ancient America. We will have much more to say about these ancient American cultures as we proceed. Now, additional evidence of the Phoenicians in the ancient Americas exists. An Iberian Punic, that is a Phoenician inscription, found 1,000 miles from the ocean in Paraguay, states that its makers came from Cadiz, Spain. Cadiz, anciently called Gades, G-A-D-E-S, was a prominent Phoenician port, and more examples of the Phoenician-Israelite presence in ancient North America will be documented in the second book in this series on Israelite history. Phoenician maritime skills were also abundant, and it has long been known that the Phoenicians had the sailing and navigational skills to make long transoceanic voyages to distant continents. And the reader may be surprised that this has already been documented by many historians. In 1834, Sir William Betham wrote, quote, "The advancement of the ancients in the science of navigation has been much underrated." And the late Dr. Cyrus Gordon was a highly regarded archaeologist and historian of modern times. A 1996 issue of the magazine Biblical Archaeologist contained several articles devoted to Cyrus Gordon's career and his many accomplishments. Dr. Gordon wrote the following about the Old World's awareness of the New World. He said, quote, "The evidence points in the direction of an ancient maritime system of which the Mediterranean was only a small part. This is reflected in the Timaeus of Plato, which tells of an ancient Atlantic order with interests extending from America into the Mediterranean. It is futile to forget his plain reference to the continent that seals off the Atlantic Ocean on the west. This continent, which Plato mentions without more ado because it was well known to his reading public, can only be America. Unquote. Now, the McClintock and Strong Cyclopedia offers the following information about the navigational skills of the Phoenicians that enabled them to navigate across the oceans. Quote, they steered by the last star in Ursa Minor, and they could cast reckonings from the combined application of astronomy and arithmetic. Strabo, volume 16, pages 2 and 24. This nautical application of astronomy is ascribed by Callimachus to Thales, a Phoenician. And Thomas More's History of Ireland, written in 1843, adds more to the story. It says, quote, at no time, however remote, has the interposition of sea presented much obstacle to the migratory dispositions of mankind. The Phoenicians, with far more knowledge, it is probable, of the art of navigation than modern assumption gives them credit for, were to be seen in the Mediterranean, the Baltic, the Atlantic, and everywhere upon the waters. Unquote. Thomas Johnson's 1913 book, Did the Phoenicians Discover America?, offers much evidence on the mechanics of Phoenician navigational skills and tools. He begins by saying that the compass was clearly a Phoenician invention, and adds that the Phoenicians determined suitable sailing seasons by the rise and setting of the Pleiades. Johnson adds, quote, once steering by a stellar object took place, which was clearly of Phoenician origin, supplemented by the use of the magnet, which enabled the navigator, when the weather was cloudy, to determine his position and direction. Also, it is equally clear, a Phoenician invention. Then the last obstacle to a complete mastery of the sea was removed. Unquote. And Johnston explains that early magnets utilized lodestones, which were stones with magnetic properties. These served as compasses by always pointing to magnetic north when suspended or when allowed to float freely in a water compass. The Phoenicians' ingenuity was remarkable, as it allowed them to know their ship's heading, and their ship's direction, whether it was day or night, clear or cloudy. This ability would allow them to not only cross the oceans with confidence, but maintain reasonably fixed sailing schedules, an important aspect to the commercially minded Phoenicians. And Dr. Barry Fell commented on the Phoenicians' regular sailing schedules to ancient America, as noted earlier. Now, the reader might justifiably wonder at this point, given the extensive evidence of Old World civilization in ancient America, why is it that America's history books have not been updated with this new information? Well, the reason is, unfortunately, that the modern academic establishment as a whole is in a state of denial regarding these discoveries because the facts overthrow established theories and establish the Bible as a credible history source. And that is politically incorrect and totally unacceptable. Now, Dr. Fell noted that some archaeologists were so deeply in denial about the realities of ancient America that they tried to dismiss clearly readable ancient inscriptions as accidental markings made by plowshares and roots of trees and colonial stone-cutting drills. Ancient American dolmens, megalithic monuments consisting of a large slab stone positioned atop smaller supporting stones have been found in New York, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, which parallel Old World dolmens, and these locations are all near the ancient Phoenician, Celtic temple and calendar complex called Mystery Hill in New Hampshire. These obviously man-made structures have even been called glacial erratics to deny the obvious evidence of old world ties to ancient America. Now, it is most unfortunate that some in modern academia have resorted to such unscholarly, fanciful extremes to maintain a state of denial regarding the evidence of Old World colonization in ancient America. And as a result, the exciting story of ancient America's history has been largely withheld from the American public. Unfortunately, the concept that Columbus discovered America in 1492 has become such a cherished dogma that it now commands an almost superstitious devotion from modern academics. Columbus was a very brave mariner, but he was clearly preceded by other discoverers and colonists from the Old World who settled the New World millennia before Columbus. And Columbus's voyage was a courageous effort, reestablishing New World links after the Dark Ages, but it is now known that such links commonly existed prior to the Dark Ages. Now, so far, we have discussed only the Phoenician inscriptions and presence in the New World. As noted earlier, the ancient Egyptians were also allies of King Solomon during his reign. The Egyptian navies were also skilled in oceanic navigation, utilizing the Semitic inhabitants of ancient Libya as their mariners. The ancient Egyptian-Libyan fleet sailed across the Indian Ocean and sent exploration and mining expeditions into the Pacific Ocean. The Egyptians mined gold in Sumatra, and writings and drawings of their Pacific explorations are found as far away as the Hawaiian Islands, as the Egyptians roamed the Indian and Pacific Oceans for gold during the period 1000 BC. Now, that date, about 1000 BC, is significant, as that is the time when the United Kingdom of Israel under David's and Solomon's kingdoms moved to world prominence, and with the Phoenicians and Egyptians serving as Solomon's allies, that the Egyptian fleet would be searching a large portion of the world for gold during a time which included the reign of King Solomon will become more significant when we later examine King Solomon's insatiable appetite for gold. Now let's look at the Israelite colonies in the New World. So far, we have only scratched the surface of the subject of ancient civilization being present in North America, so let's examine additional evidence of their presence in the ancient New World. Let's consider the languages of the Triple Alliance of Israel, Egypt, and Phoenicia in the time of King Solomon. Their languages included the Semitic language shared by the Israelites and Phoenicians, with mere dialectical differences, and Egyptian and the language of the North African Libyan sailors of the Egyptian Navy. Now let us now examine evidence that North America was both explored and colonized by people speaking Phoenician, Hebrew, Egyptian, and ancient Libyan. In Dr. Fell's book, America B.C., he includes much evidence of the exploration of American soil by ancient people with the above language groups. And we have already examined evidence from his book that the Phoenicians had a significant presence in North America and that the Phoenician god Baal was worshipped at an ancient temple site in New Hampshire. Rawlinson cited the habit of the Phoenicians in bringing their religion wherever they went, and of building temples in their colonies to honor their gods. So the existence of a temple dedicated to Baal at the ancient New England temple site is perfectly consistent with their habits. Explorations and settlements in ancient America would logically be concentrated on major inland waterways, and evidence of their presence has been found in such localities. A major archaeological find, A stele inscribed with ancient Old World languages was found in 1877 in a burial mound near Davenport, Iowa. Unfortunately, this New World equivalent of the Rosetta Stone was largely ignored because no one could read it. The false dogma that no Old World explorers prior to Columbus could have been on our continent also affected people's perceptions. If it had been discovered in Europe, it would surely have been recognized for what it was. A trilingual archaeological stele of ancient cultures. But since it was found in the American Midwest, it had to wait for a century to be appreciated. Surprisingly, one of the reasons that this stele was initially rejected was that it contained some signs resembling Hebrew and others resembling Phoenician. This ancient stele contains joint inscriptions in three ancient languages: Iberian Punic, a language related to and descended from Phoenician Hebrew, Egyptian, and ancient Libyan. These are the language groups of the Triple Alliance that the Bible reveals began in the reign of Solomon. And since this ancient stele confirms these groups were traveling and working together in the interior of North America, it indicates that this alliance not only existed, but also had a global reach. Now, indeed, Dr. Feld described the stele shown above as one of the most important steles ever discovered. Why, then, is this priceless evidence of ancient exploration in North America not featured in history textbooks? Again, we are confronted by the refusal of modern academia to accept the obvious because of their devotion to the false dogma that nobody could have discovered America before Columbus. This ancient Iowan stele, attested by Dr. Barry Fell to be genuine, confirms that the language groups of King Solomon's alliance were cooperating in joint expeditions as far away as the American Midwest. And unless it was a well-established practice for the nations with these language groups to be in joint expeditions, there would have been no need for parallel inscriptions on the same stone. And Dr. Fell dates this stele as follows. He says, quote, "The date is unlikely to be earlier than 800 B.C., for we do not know of Iberian or Libyan inscriptions earlier than that date. The Egyptian text may merely be a local American copy of some original. That original could be as old as 1400 B.C., to judge by the writing style, and it seems clear that Iberian and Punic speakers were living in Iowa in the 9th century B.C. Now, this stone is the property of the Putnam Museum of History and Natural Science in Davenport, Iowa. It's called the Davenport Stele in Davenport, Iowa, at the Putnam Museum of History and Natural Science. Now, Dr. Fell also wrote that this ancient inscription found in Iowa could date to around 700 B.C. A dating of 800 to 700 B.C. is very consistent with biblical accounts of that period. That these language groups were still acting in such close concert that they left a trilingual inscription at that time indicates that they were still cooperating very closely in transoceanic voyages. The Bible reveals an alliance of these linguistic groups was established under King Solomon during the 10th century B.C. The terms Iberian and Punic indicate languages that are closely related to and descended from the Phoenician Hebrew language. And indeed, the term Iberian comes from the name Eber, the forefather of the Hebrews. The term Iberian proclaims Hebrew roots, and Dr. Fell noted that the Phoenician character of the Iberian inscriptions on either side of the Atlantic and Solomon's reign began in obedience to God. But by 800 B.C., when the Iowan stele was apparently inscribed, the Israelite-Phoenician-Egyptian alliance had embraced paganism and sun worship and Baal worship. Now, the makers of the Iowan steel may have been looking for raw materials to exploit. By then, they had exhausted the copper mines of Lake Superior. However, because of a serious growing pressure on Israel and the Phoenician city-states during 800 to 700 BC, one motive for their voyage to North America may have been an effort to find a safe refuge from the Assyrian menace. Now, the next book in this series will confirm that the Phoenician Israelites had extensive settlements in the Iberian Peninsula, modern Spain, and Portugal, during most of the first millennium B.C. The ancient steel in Iowa may have been made by Israelites and Phoenicians who sailed from Iberian settlements. A date of 800 to 700 B.C. for this steel confirms that the Triple Alliance of Israel, Egypt, and Phoenicia lasted long after the lifetime of King Solomon. The Bible records that the 10 tribes of Israel forsook the worshiping of the Creator God, the God of Abraham, shortly after Solomon's death, and they adopted the religious customs of Egypt, Tyre, and Sidon. Biblical accounts show that Israel and Phoenicia were still very closely allied during the reigns of King Ahab of Israel, around 850 BC, and there is no evidence that their alliance suffered a breach until approximately 721 BC, when Israel ceased to be a nation in the Middle East. And also after Israel and Judah split into two separate Hebrew kingdoms, Egypt did fight periodic wars with Judah. Peaceful relations apparently prevailed between Egypt and Israel during this time, however. Therefore, the Iowa steel showing that these ancient nations were still working together closely around 800 BC in the New World is purely and totally consistent with biblical accounts. Now, Dr. Fell wrote that this ancient steel and other artifacts were found in an Iowa burial mound, that this burial mound dated from 800 BC, and it confirmed the presence of Semites and Egyptians in ancient America. And it begs the following question. How many other burial mounds in ancient North America were made by Old World cultures? Now, another steel exhibiting an ancient Egyptian-Libyan script was found on Long Island, New York. The photograph is on the opposite page. This inscription, according to Dr. Fell, probably dates from about the 9th century B.C. In his discussion of the inscriptions found on the Davenport and Long Island steels, Dr. Fell noted clear similarities between the written script of the Mi'kmaq Algonquin Indians, and that of ancient Egypt. This analysis indicates that the Egyptians continued trading with ancient American inhabitants long after the Kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians. Additionally, another steel was unearthed in Oklahoma with reference to the Phoenician and Egyptian gods of Baal and Amun-Ra, with an inscription described as an extract from the Hymn to the Atone by Pharaoh Akhenaten, which dates from the 13th century B.C., and this steel is written in Iberian Punic, related to Hebrew Phoenician, but is dated by Fell as scarcely older than 800 B.C. This steel also supports the biblical account of Israelite Phoenician and Egyptian cooperation. Now, why is Pharaoh Akhenaten mentioned in an Egyptian writing in ancient North America? Well, at this point, some striking information about Egyptian history finds a solid parallel in biblical events. David Roll's book, Pharaohs and Kings, offers a revised chronology of Egypt's dynastic rulers, which proposes remarkable parallels to biblical events and personalities. It has long been known that the reign of the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten, Dr. Fell's Akhenaten, marked a temporary period in which an Egyptian ruler rejected the pantheon of Egyptian gods and required a virtually monotheistic devotion to the god Aten, or Aton, And Rawls' New Chronology of Egypt's Dynasties has Akhenaten being a contemporary of King David of Israel. Now, if this is in fact the case, it argues that this inscription may have been made soon after the reign of Solomon, as it had to be in a time when Israel, ruled by Jeroboam, had turned to paganism, but when there were Egyptians still loyal to the beliefs of the heretic Pharaoh Akhenaten, and Akhenaten's belief system was rejected by later pharaohs. So it is difficult to make sense of a hymn to Aton, Akhenaten's god, being present with an Egyptian contingent much past the reign of Jeroboam of Israel. Now, the internal turmoil in Egypt caused by Akhenaten's rejection of traditional Egyptian deities provided a golden opportunity for King David's Israel to focus all of its attention eastward against Assyria, while devoting scant attention to Egypt as a potential rival. And the Bible relates that Egypt became Israel's ally during King Solomon's time. So Israel's border with Egypt was secured during his reign as well. David Roll makes the following observation about this time. He said, "During this period of Akhenaten's reign, and for decades afterwards, Egypt became militarily impotent, due almost entirely to the politically naive rule of the heretic. The prosperous northern empire had rapidly disintegrated. This chaotic era would have provided the opportunity for a new state to come into being in Canaan, and this is precisely what happened with the establishment of King David's Israel." Well, I got to pause right here, give you a reminder, so let me make a little arrow so we can come back here. We're looking at Israel's rise to greatness, the first British and American Empire, about 1000 B.C., when we come back. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by pre-arrangement. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and that the Law Hour website is updated every week and has our radio log, schedule, and archive. It can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. And finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct. That's 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a book written by Stephen Collins. Its title is The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. It's one of five books in a series. The five books in the series are called The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel, Israel's Lost Empires, Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower and Its Role in Biblical History, and The Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found. Now, that's four of them. Last time I talked to Mr. Collins, he had a fifth book that he had not put out yet. It should be out by now. I think I'll call him here and ask him about it. But I don't have a copy of that one, but he did tell me that it was ready for publication. That was a month or two ago. So I think there's five of them in the series. Now, if you'd like to purchase these books, I've been giving you his name and home phone number. That's so that you listeners to the Law Hour can get them autographed. I personally like to get books that are autographed by the authors. I have a number of them here in my own collection, and I have a pretty extensive library, and many of them are autographed by the authors. And Stephen Collins will autograph these books, and you can buy them directly from him, or you can buy them from the publishing house, whichever you prefer. They're about $20 a piece. I don't have an exact price. I sent him a $100 bill, and he sent me five books, and then I lost that new one, I guess. I don't have it here. And his phone number, to see if I can find it here, Collins, 605-361-5069. That's Stephen Collins, 605-361-5069. He's a member of the Epigraphic Society. Barry Fell founded that Epigraphic Society. It's the society of those historians and scientists who have been looking at these steles, burial mounds, pyramids, and ancient archaeological finds here in North America. Two other really neat books that I want to share with you. One of them is called In Plain Sight, written by Gloria Farley. In Plain Sight by Gloria Farley. And the other, America B.C. by Barry Fell. Now, Fell was a historian and linguist from Harvard. And he's no lightweight of him by himself. Now, he's dead now. But for many, many years, he'd been traveling all over America looking at all of these various ancient sites. And his specialty was in reading these ancient languages. And then, of course, Stephen Collins comes along with his knowledge of the scriptures and puts together with the scriptures all of this secular historical information. And it's a masterful series of books. I've rated it in my own rating system, a 1 in 100 book. If you went out and looked for 100 books and read 100 books, you wouldn't find a single book to compare to any one of these five that Stephen Collins has written. So needless to say, it's high on my recommendation for every listener. Everybody in America should see this. If for no other reason, just so that you can see the lies and the propaganda that has been foisted off upon all of us, especially those with PhDs, masters, and letters after their names. You can order this from BibleBlessings.net. Just go to www.BibleBlessings.net, box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. Now that zip code is 48068. And then the zip code plus 4 is dash 1778, which is their post office box number. Again, that's Bible Blessings, box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068-1778. I'd go to their website and find out what the prices are on these books. And if you'd like to have it autographed, why don't you call Collins at home at 605-361-5069. He lives up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And tell him Little Georgie sent you, and please autograph my book. Now, I've mentioned $100 for the five books, but hey, if you just want to buy one book at a time, just, I imagine, $20. Call him on the phone and ask him how much he wants. I think that $20 bill will more than cover it. All right, now, we were talking about the King Solomon's Golden Age and Israel's Empire, reading from the book The Origins and Empire of Ancient Israel. And keep in mind, all I can do is scratch the surface. I mean, I'm just giving you the highlights here, boys and girls. And these books are so well documented that it'll bore you to tears just looking at the index of persons, places, and subjects, and the references from the scripture, and all of the bibliography, you know, from the Encyclopedia Americana, and the numerous books. I can't even count them all. I'll count the pages. What is that? 1, 2, 3, 4 pages of bibliography here. And that's just in this one book. That's just one book. Every book is documented upon documented upon documented and so on. So this guy knows what he's talking about, and it's easy to read. God, you'll love it. Once you pick it up, I don't think you'll put it down. I can hardly put him down. This guy Collins is about like, who can I say or compare this guy to? You pick up a book, you know, written by some guy like Kent Hovind, you know, is a pretty interesting guy. I'll turn on some of his tapes sometimes. I don't always agree with everybody's philosophies and politics and one thing and another, but, you know, if they've got a good way of gab, a good gift of gab, and they can put the story together. Well, this guy Collins has got a good gift of gab, and he's got a good way of putting the story together. It's a hell of a story to tell. Well, let me get on with some more of the story here. He says, in other words, Egypt was impotent during the reign of King David and also for decades afterward, and that is during the reign of King Solomon. Now, one reason for Egypt's relative decline was the rise of Israel to world power status, and the impotence of Egypt was also caused by the severe internal stresses resulting from the pharaoh's rejection of the old Egyptian pantheon, to which the priests and much of the populace remained loyal. The internal stresses in the reign of Akhenaten would have kept Egypt at the brink of civil war, unable to project power outside of its own borders. And also, since Solomon's reign was a time of peace and Egypt was allied to Israel, there was no need for Egypt to be warlike. When Israel's civil war later split Israel's tribes into two rival kingdoms, Egypt quickly attacked Judah and Jerusalem, asserting its influence over its northern regions. However, Egypt attacked only Judah. They remained an ally of the northern kingdom of Israel, formed by the 10 tribes of Israel. The first king of the northern kingdom of Israel's name was Jeroboam, J-E-R-O-B-O-A-M. And he had been a courtier and friend of Egypt's pharaoh. You'll see this in 1 Kings 11, verse 40. And one of his first official deeds was to institute the worship of Egypt's Apis bulls in the northern kingdom of Israel. We see that in 1 Kings 12, verses 28 through 30. King Jeroboam chose to seek security in alliances with Egypt, Tyre, and Sidon instead of obedience to God. Jeroboam's rejection of Israel's God, the God of Abraham, set a pattern for future kings which would never be reversed. And while the smaller kingdom of Judah periodically had good rulers who served the God of Abraham, the northern kingdom of Israel never returned to God. The 10 tribes were politically, socially, and religiously immersed into the Phoenician culture that was also allied with Egypt until the fall of Samaria. The famous Amara tablets, which preserve many letters to Pharaoh's court from rulers of petty city-states in Palestine during the reign of Pharaoh Akhenaten, take on a whole new perspective in David Rawls' revised chronology. It is known the Amarna tablets were written in the reign of Pharaoh Akhenaten, and as they were found in the ruins of Akhenaten's capital city, Amara, Egypt's other pharaohs ruled from other cities. Now, the events described on the Amarna tablets coincide with biblical events and mention prominent biblical characters. In David Rawls' words, quote, the Amarna period is contemporary with the rise of the Israelite monarchy. The Amarna letters log the whole process, beginning with the Hebrew revolt in the central hill country of Palestine at the beginning of King Saul's reign, and ending with the assault upon Jerusalem in the 8th year of King David. It is a vital clue that the Amarna tablet seemed to end with the 8th year of King David's reign. That's the year that David conquered Jerusalem and became king over all of the United Tribes of Israel. You'll see that in 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 through 10. Now, when David unified all of the tribes of Israel under his unified command, these petty city-state rulers who had been writing to Pharaoh Akhenaten ceased their messages. So the reason should be obvious. David tolerated no opponents as he consolidated the territory under his rule. Rulers of city-states within his claimed domain either submitted to David or died. And the Amarna letters mention the leaders and activities of a group of people called the Habiru, which is an obvious term for the Hebrews. Rawl notes that the Sumerian logogram form for the word Habiru is S-A-G-A-Z. Now, the term S-A-G-A-Z is a form of the root word of the Israelite forefather, Isaac, the Saga, Saki, or Saka, which Genesis 21:12 and Genesis 48:14 through 16 had prophesied would be the name attached to the birthright Israelite tribes. David Rawl asserts that the Amarna tablets identify Israel's King Saul as Labayu, a king who rose to power in Palestine. King Labayu wrote letters to Pharaoh Akhenaten in the Canaanite tongue, which is simply early Hebrew, in David Rawl's words. Now, for a full accounting of the Amarna tablets' description of biblical events and personalities, then the reader is referred to David Rawl's aforementioned book. However, several instances will be cited here. Many readers are familiar with the story of David's close friendship with Jonathan, the son of Saul. His friendship infuriated King Saul, as we read in 1 Samuel 20, verses 30 through 31. And this story is also found in the Amarna letters as David Rawl describes it. In Labayu's third letter to Pharaoh, EA 254, we learn that the king's son has been implicated in the activities of the Habiru, David's rebel band. This is without the knowledge of his father. Labayu, Saul, writes, "The king wrote for my son. I did not know that my son was consorting with the Habiru. I herewith hand him over." Here again is a clear parallel with the story of King Saul's reign and Jonathan's friendship with David, as related in the Bible. Now, the Bible records that Saul died fighting the Philistines in a battle that the Hebrew Israelites lost, as recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 31. One of the Amarna letters to the Pharaoh is from the Philistine king of Gath, the city of Goliath, who tells Pharaoh of Labayu's death. It says, quote, "Let the king be informed that the Habiru, singular, who was raised up against the lands, the God of my Lord, delivered him to me, and I have smitten him." Unquote. Now, the obsequious language of the Philistine king indicates that while Egypt was in temporary decline, the chieftains of Palestine recognized that they were still in Egypt's sphere of influence, and they wanted to not alienate the Pharaoh. It was not until David united all of Israel's tribes that Egypt's titular influence in Palestine ended. According to Rawl, the following biblical characters are named in the Amarna letters. David is referred to as Dadua, and Rawl supports this conclusion by noting, quote, "In its earliest Hebrew form, the name David is written D-W-D, 1 Samuel 16, verse 13, and the Septuagint renders the name as D-A-D, 1 Kings 2, verse 33, and Ecclesiastes 47, verse 1. Rawl also notes that Joab, King David's army commander, is named Ahab, that is, in Hebrew, Yoab, Y-O-A-B, and in the Armanah letters, and that David's father Jesse is called Yeshua, Y-I-S-H-U-Y-A. Non-Israelites mentioned in the Bible are also identified by Rawl in the Amarna letters, and he cites Goliath as being the Galatu of the Amarna records, and he identifies biblical Syrian kings, Hadadezer of Zobah and Toi of Hamath, as being named in the Amarna letters. All of these letters are in museums and are available for inspection today. They have been translated. And their connection with the historical story in the Bible is undisputed. Now, why is it that secular historians go to such lengths to hide these obvious biblical and secular historical interfacings in ancient times? Is it because it isn't politically correct? Is that what the problem is? Now, we have seen evidence that Baal-worshipping Hebrew Phoenicians were in ancient America. But what about worshippers of the God of Israel? Well, one major barrier to finding relics of the worshippers of God, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, is that such worshippers were forbidden by God to build these elaborate altars. In Exodus 20, verses 24 through 26, for instance, God commanded the Israelites to make plain altars of earth and natural stone, and forbid them to use or to make those altars shaped by any tools, and added that altars not be placed at the head of staircases. Now, these instructions effectively eliminated any man-made religious structures that the pagans built to commemorate their gods, and which can be unearthed by archaeologists today. There could have been many worshippers of Yahweh in ancient America at the time that Israel served God under King Solomon, but there would be little or no evidence of them because the God of Abraham's instructions on altar building prohibited making these kinds of monuments. And also Exodus 20 verse 23 records that God forbade making gods of gold and silver. And the second of the Ten Commandments forbids the manufacture of any graven image as part of religious worship. This eliminates the true worshipers of God from leaving behind any of the kinds of idolatrous temples and artifacts that we find scattered all over North America in honor of Baal and the sun god. So this further eliminates the types of artifacts or idols which pagan worshippers commonly manufactured. God gave these instructions so the people would keep their minds focused on God and the laws of God and not on physical objects. However, there is evidence that worshippers of Yahweh, the God of Israel, were present in ancient America. At Hidden Mountain near Las Lunas, New Mexico, the Ten Commandments were written on a large stone in ancient Hebrew. Now, there is a scripture in the Bible that requires that we all have the Ten Commandments written and placed upon our doorposts. So it is consistent with the scripture to have the Ten Commandments written and placed upon a doorpost or a lintel. Dr. Fell noted that the inscription written in ancient Hebrew letters of the style of the Moab stone about 1000 BC was not translated until 1949. A dating of around 1000 BC would place this inscription during the reigns of Kings David and Solomon of the United Kingdom of Israel, when Israel was indeed serving the God of the Bible. The famous Moabite stone referred to above was found in the Middle East and refers to wars between Israel and Moab in the 9th century BC, during the time of the separate kingdoms of Israel and Judah. George Morehouse, a geologist who studied this ancient Hebrew Decalogue inscription, estimated the inscription to be 500 to 2,000 years old based upon the weathered patina of the rock. However, accurately dating the inscription on the basis of weatherization was made very difficult, if not impossible, by the fact that the inscriptions had received periodic scrubbings, which removed evidence of the weatherization needed for the dating. Further complicating the dating of this ancient Hebrew inscription is the statement that the punctuation of the inscription matched that of ancient Greek manuscripts, such as the Codex of the 4th century AD. Well, Dr. Fell's discussion of this artifact stated that separation points like those in this inscription date as early as 1200 BC, but that the oldest known record of some punctuation marks, carats to denote an insertion to correct an omission, date to the Codex Sinaiticus of the 4th century AD. This does not date the Hebrew inscription to the 4th century AD, but is rather an example of the oldest known occurrence of a similar punctuation mark. How long such punctuation was used prior to the 4th century AD is not yet known. Now, in view of the above, this Las Lunas inscription predates the arrival of Columbus by at least 1,000 years, but it most likely dates to the time of King Solomon for several reasons. The first reason is that the inscription is in the Paleo-Hebrew characters in use from approximately 1200 to 600 BC, which includes the reigns of King Solomon. Now, a second piece of evidence is that the inscription says, or what the inscription says, since it is an inscription of the Ten Commandments given by God to Moses, it was obviously made by Israelites at a time when they were still worshiping the God of the Bible. And since the kingdom of Israel quickly degenerated into pagan practices after the reign of Solomon, it argues that this inscription was made during the reign of Solomon, when God's laws were still the standard for the nation, as we see in 1 Kings 10, verse 22, where it records that Solomon's sailors undertook voyages that returned after 3 years with samples of the wildlife, the apes, and the peacocks from other continents. Such fleets could easily have visited the New World during a 3-year voyage. Well, I'm about out of time, and I think I'll just make my mark right there on page 220. We've got two more programs. Next time, I'm going to take up the Lost Ten Tribes of Israel Found, the chapter that deals with America and Britain. Remember, I said the Israel's rise to greatness is the first British and American empire about 1000 BC. Now we need to tie in Britain and America, and we'll do that next time, right here on the Law Hour. All right, keep in mind that the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the Law School. That's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio logs, schedule, and archives. All right, we're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.